Thank you for listening to this Podcast One Sportsnet production, available on Apple Podcasts and Podcast One.
Welcome to Real Jam Radio. I'm Danny Lurie, your host, and so happy to have you with us for this episode. My guest is Sirit Sohi, talented writer, and also she had an interesting recent piece on Klay Thompson. So we start out going through Klay and the piece, and then also Durant, Westbrook, and Harden, especially in light of Wednesday's game, Warriors-Thunder game, and all of what ensued there. And then we go on to a lot of other discussion factors. For those of you who are interested, I will have timestamps on this episode so you can take a look when we get into various topics. It will not include everything we discuss, but it'll give you a pretty good idea. And this episode is brought to you by ZipRecruiter. You can go to ziprecruiter.com/sportsfan and list jobs for free. Audible. You can go to www.audible.com/try now, and you can check out, with a free trial, their amazing service, audiobooks, and other audio programming. It's absolutely fantastic. I've used it for a while. And my old friend, Blue Apron. BlueApron.com/RealGM, and you can get 3 meals for free, including free shipping on your first order. Fantastic food delivery service, and a longtime friend of the podcast. So, episode with Sirit runs about an hour and a half. I really did enjoy it, and I think you'll enjoy it as well. Thanks so much for coming on.
Thanks for having me.
We should probably start with Klay Thompson, considering you just wrote a piece about him for Sports Unearthed. And he is a fascinating figure with this Warriors team because he occupies a fundamentally different niche than just about everybody else on this diverse team.
Yeah, he's really like the yin to their yang, I think. Well, I would actually say that was more accurate to last year. I think him and Durant are very similar, at least in their ability. Durant definitely isolates more, but like, let's say, I think Klay is kind of like a good template for what Durant might be doing if later in the season when he gets more acclimated to the system and if he completely buys into not going isolation all the time. Klay's just got such a quick trigger, which is so great for this Warriors team because it kind of like lets everybody else handle a ball and feel like they're involved.
Yeah, he occupies a different space, which is exactly what they need. I think about this with Draymond also, because they're both low usage isn't really right with Klay, because he does have a relatively high usage, but it's low possession, high effectiveness, and you need players like that on your team, especially when you have individuals like Curry and Durant, who are talented at creating for other people, either through their own passes or just defensive attention.
Right. Like, what I wrote in the piece was that he's one of the higher usage players on the Warriors, but out of the core four, he's the lowest in time of possession and in touches because, you know, he gets a ball, he's really, really efficient with his dribbles. He sees a drive, he goes and takes it really quickly. He might, you know, pump fake one dribble, pull up, but he doesn't really, you know, needlessly handle the ball too much. So that's really helpful because at the end of the day, we can look at usage stats, but the players aren't. For the most part, most players aren't really looking at those advanced stats. So if they're touching the ball a lot, they feel like they're involved. And Klay can have a high usage because he's just strictly ending possessions. And he'll feel good, too, because he's scoring the ball.
That's what he does. On offense, that's what he does. And
yeah.
And he occupies that specific area for this team because everybody else has this penchant for overpassing. It's toning down a little bit as we get closer to the end of the season and these players are a little bit more acclimated. They don't feel like they have to do everything. It's not like when you're the new kid in the school and you want to be nice to everybody. Like they're kind of figuring out what their spots are. But it's intriguing because Thompson just is what he is, and the holdover guys knew exactly what that was that when he's open, he's gonna take the shot. When he's not open, he's probably gonna take the shot.
Right. I think he also occupies, like, an interesting dynamic in the Warriors in that, like, he kind of doesn't really care about, like, the kumbaya part of it. Like, I think a lot of the other players buy in or at least, like, project that they're buying in. But Klay is kind of the guy who's like, I'm not sacrificing shit. He's not really, like, going out all in the media. Like, I think, like, if there's any conception of him in like, the mind of fans, it's like this. He's kind of just like this jock who puts up shots and like, it's like, oh, great. I'm in this great system and like it's revolutionary and it represents a bunch of Silicon Valley stuff. Like, cool. That's fine. But like, I'm not going to play into it.
He also helps set the tone in terms of dealing with everything that comes with being this team, because while Draymond is certainly this as well, Klay is so comfortable in his own skin and always has been, that he helped kind of establish that foundation for guys on this team doing what they want, being candid, being honest. It's just that his being candid, being direct is very, very, very different from a guy like Draymond or what Durant is becoming.
Right. Like, I think a lot of the players on the team kind of get bogged down in complexity almost. And Klay is kind of, and Draymond to an extent as well, they're kind of just like, no, like, let's keep it simple here. And it's kind of like the same thing on the court too, like with the overpassing of everybody else, which we saw a little bit of last night too, as much as it is, starting to stop. But, you know, like, Klay is just the guy who's like, oh, like, this is a good shot. Like, let's keep it simple. Just take it.
He has toned it down a little bit during the Kerr era from Mark Jackson, just because the idea of expectations, but really what that turned into was just him understanding those looks and taking out the 10% that was probably his worst attempts. And that has made him so much better because he has height. He has a height advantage. And as you said, he has a really quick release. And now with the amount of offensive talent they have on the floor, there are times where even though you don't want him to ever be open, you kind of have to allow that to happen because the other options are even worse.
Right. Although there are times too. So one of my favorite developing wrinkles with the Warriors now is in transition. I think teams are still so scared of Klay and Curry that they'll leave Durant open for a dunk. Like, I've seen that happen a lot more, and it's kind of like so representative of what the Warriors are, like, of like where the league is going, that guys like subconsciously are so much more scared of a three-pointer that one of the best scorers like in a generation is open for a dunk, and you know, you're not even paying attention to that.
Yeah, arguably the even more striking one of that is that there have been probably around 10 times this year where Draymond Green has gone coast to coast on a rebound and dunked it, and no one ever really stopped him because right. They were so freaked out about everyone else. And Draymond is quick with the ball in his hands, but he's not, you know, he's not a water bug just like out there. You can't react to it. It's just that teams are making a conscious choice that it's worse. And also sometimes it's that one guy makes a bad decision, like two people do it right and then the third guy fails to execute.
Right, and I think a lot of that failure in execution is just, like, perception, too. It used to be that, you know, you wouldn't guard Curry a certain way. You'd be like, oh, I don't have to go that far up on him. And I think the league has adjusted to that to the point where, like, the rest of the team is just getting open on layups.
Yeah, the irony of it is that Klay still never finds Steph in transition. It's a running joke for us Warriors writers because it's been true since Klay was a rookie that he's good at many things. He's not great at passing in transition, and so he's found him, I think, if I had to ballpark it, I'd say around 5 times in the last 4 years in transition. It's great. It's absolutely great. I wanted to ask you about, because you're coming at this from a different perspective, we're recording this on Thursday morning after Warriors Thunder. You watched the game. What did you think about the whole Pachulia Westbrook dust up and how that affects, you know, the dynamic between and with these two teams moving forward?
I think it just like adds to the animosity, well, at least from Westbrook's side. It's kind of weird to see how Durant and Westbrook interact with each other. Obviously, you know, they had that little conversation that we'll probably be talking about for the next few days on the court, even though nobody's going to know what they talked about. But you know, like, Westbrook is so anti-Warriors, anti-Durant. Like, he says they're not on speaking terms. They, you know, he's always, like, he had the photography outfit that we wore last year. And I think Durant just doesn't really care. Like, he's kind of just like, oh, yeah, you know, that guy's always going to be in my life. Like, you know, like, it's kind of weird because, like, I think at any other time, like, people would kind of be siding with Durant, but we're so into petty right now that like, there's a lot of people that are just like loving what Westbrook is doing. Anyway, I think it just adds to it because like at the end of the day, Zaza, I think last night said something along the lines of, yeah, you know, if you start, you keep playing, it happens, whatever. And Westbrook's like, I'm getting it back for that.
My analogy for the Westbrook Durant thing at this point is it's when a relationship broke up, and whether you could talk about whether it was justified or not, that's a whole other conversation. But the weirdness that transpires when one party moves on relatively quickly and the other one doesn't, Like, I feel like Durant has basically just closed the book on that part of his life. You know, he has his memories, he has his experiences. You know, he was, he talked after the game about how he's like, yeah, I got to see those guys again and all the kind of stuff. And then when you listen to Westbrook, when you see Westbrook, he sees it totally differently. And it's not that either one of those is wrong or either one of them is right. It's just two different ways of dealing with the same circumstance that also is a lot easier to understand when you know that one person made the choice and one person was just affected by it.
Yeah, yeah. Westbrook definitely has a lot more justification for being salty about what happened. But at the same time, though, he loves playing into it, too. I mean, I don't know how upset he is versus how much he's performing being upset because he knows it plays into this image of Russell Westbrook, right?
That's true. So, he does agree very well.
Mm-hmm. He really does. I mean, it's kind of turned him into a martyr.
Yeah, and it's also fed into this season for him where the dynamic was going into the year was Russ going it alone, even though they have some good players, but you know, Russ going it alone, and everything that we've seen has really fed that dynamic, and he has done nothing, not that he should, he has done nothing to dissuade people from that other than giving credit to his teammates, which of course he should and is proper to do.
Right, yeah, I mean, he's completely playing into it. There's no one part of him that's even trying to like, oh, like, this part isn't true or anything like that. Like, if you peg anything individualist on him, like, he's just going to double down on it at this point, I think.
I have trouble reconciling some of the elements of his triple-double because, like, if he averages it for a year, it's insanely impressive. There is nothing that can be done to discount it. And the difference in pace between now and when Oscar did it is another significant factor that goes in Russ's favor. But at the same point, it's convoluted because they need him to do all of that, but it's also really the only way this team works. So it is individual excellence, but it's in such a specific way that I, at least personally, I don't feel like I appreciate it all the time for what it is.
I mean, do they need him to do it all the time?
From a ball handling perspective, they probably do. Maybe not everything in terms of, there isn't really anybody else in this team who can create much for others.
I mean, I would say Oladipo is developing as something of a secondary creator for them. There's a lot of young guys on this team, and if you dominate the ball as much as Westbrook does, I don't think anybody, even if they have that potential, gets a chance to show that they can do it.
That's a good point. It also is an issue where the coaching staff isn't doing the rest of the team any favors because you can generate looks through the system. There are teams that have done that for years that, you know, maybe through ball movement and player movement, and Donovan is certainly better at that than Scotty Brooks was, but still not great in all of those elements.
Right, and I think like Westbrook almost kind of forced their hand with that too, just because of how adamant he was about his loyalty to OKC and just staying and like, you know, this is my team, I'm going to carry them. It was just like, you know, he kind of forced that to happen a little bit. Like, even going back to last year too, it's not like those guys were particularly buying into any new offensive philosophies that they weren't under Brooks. So he kind of set it up for himself that way.
I was just thinking about the idea that these three famous all-star MVP caliber players that were former teammates now are in systems that are all really reflective of not only what they are as players, but what they want to be in terms of players in a system. Harden has a team built around him, but it's still ball movement, exciting, periodically infuriating. Russ is the alpha and the omega on a team that is scrappy and outperform, you know, maybe arguably outperforming their talent level. And Durant is a successful piece in the best team in the league.
Yeah, yeah, I think, yeah, you're definitely onto something, especially, I mean, I think a lot of people would say that about Westbrook and Harden, but I've never really thought about Durant that way. But it's certainly true if you just take his skills into isolation. Of course, he has a lot of, I mean, isolation the other way. He has a lot of ISO habits that aren't particularly Warriors-esque, but he's also, you know, this really dynamic guy who can switch on defense, and he's a really good shooter. He can shoot from pretty much anywhere on the floor and come off screens. Like, he really does, in some ways, represent the Warriors in a way that I didn't really think about until you brought it up right now.
For reasons that are unsurprising and logical, I was asked and talked a lot about the prospect of Durant on the Warriors before it happened. And the point that I always fell back on was that Durant, and I knew this from covering him for years and watching interviews and everything like that, is that he had a very good understanding of the league in general, but specifically the Warriors and what they did. And my logic to it, because people are like, oh, how's it going to fit, is that I said, if he comes to Oakland, he will be doing so with the knowledge of what is expected of him, and that it is indicative of some larger preferences within him, and it's taking some time. I wonder if the Warriors kind of gave him the stretch where he was anchoring the second unit to placate him in that way, and then they might be realizing, oh, he doesn't even really need that. He works within this team system and thrives in a different way, and now they've made this switch after the Cleveland game, but really after Sacramento, to having Draymond Green run that and get even more of Durant and Curry together.
Well, yeah, I think it might even go back to the Memphis game too. That's when Draymond shoot him out, and, like, you know, he tried to isolate on, I think it was Zach Randolph. So he still has to beat those habits out of himself a little bit. As much as, I mean, I don't, like, that's really the question, isn't it? It's just how much Durant is really that guy, and how much he wants to be that guy, and how much of, like, you know, some of his more selfish habits are born out of him playing in OKC versus, you know, just who he is as a player. But I think, like, yeah, I think it's coming along. It's obviously going to be a long process, but, you know, you're really starting to see it. I think you saw it a lot in the Cavs game. Not so much yesterday, just because, well, A, nobody else was really going off, and then him and Westbrook kind of got into it, and that's one of those moments where, hey, you kind of want to let him kind of take over like that.
That's true. Also, his shots were really within the flow of the offense. Like, Durant, yeah, hasn't, the only game that I can think of where he really just said, I'm taking the reins from a shooting perspective, was there was a game against Portland in, I want to say it was mid-December, where he just basically went, there's no one on this team that can guard me, I'm gonna take over for 4 to 5 minutes with the other starters on the floor, and I think he scored like 10 or 12 points in those 4 or 5 minutes. Other than that, it's broadly just being brutally efficient at the opportunities that he creates for himself and that are created for him through this offense and system.
Yeah, I'd agree with that. But that's kind of like, that's kind of what the thing with the Warriors is, though, is that most of the shots that any of the core four will take will be in the flow of the offense. But the reason they're great is because they kind of will pass up on the shot that's in the flow of the offense.
Right. And Draymond Green has been figuring that out as well. Green is not nearly the scorer that the other players are, and so figuring out when he wants to shoot and when he wants to use the threat of shooting to get a guy to come out on him and then turn it into something else.
Right. Not that there's much of a threat of shooting this year anyway, but
He still does it. I mean, he's not the greatest at it, but it's a weird, like, the idea of this, Kevin Pelton's written about it before, numerous other intelligent people have, that the idea of somebody shooting sometimes is more potent than what they actually do with it and how well they succeed, because willingness to shoot is a positive in and of itself unless you reach those ungodly levels like Marcus Smart shooting threes last year.
Right. And I think, like, to take it back to Westbrook, that's kind of the thing with the Thunder this year too. I mean, we came in thinking it's going to be Westbrook and a bunch of guys that can't shoot. Oladipo's having a good three-point shooting year. I think Sabonis, who's, you know, just been positive all around, is shooting around 36-37% for them. But, and obviously Roberson's still not quite there, but he, like, all of them, you know, hypothetically can shoot, but the fact that guys aren't really running out on them still hinders the Thunder's offense a lot.
Shooting is a lagging indicator, and it gets frustrating from time to time because you see mistakes that way. It can be advantageous to the offense if a player has an outdated reputation in a positive way or in a negative way and they're willing to shoot, but it can really hurt the Thunder because unless those guys make an opponent pay consistently, they're just going to exploit it and create limited avenues. Because even if Jeremy Grant or Roberson start hitting their threes, you probably still want guys to help on Westbrook drives because that's the best thing that the Thunder can do.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, I think the best example of this was actually, like, Nikola Mirotic for 2 straight years was considered a really, really good shooter. Guys running out on him, he's spacing the floor, where in reality, he's a really streaky shooter, and he was just letting them fly, like, at not a very, very good rate at all.
Yeah, that's a really good point. And, my God, the Bulls, I could talk about the Bulls forever, but But first, I want to talk a little bit about ZipRecruiter. We're still in January, which means it's time to get a fresh start for your business. And a key part of any successful business is making successful hiring. And at this point, posting your job in one place is not enough to find the right candidates and filter through the best candidates. You want to be on all of the best job sites, and you can do that with ZipRecruiter. ZipRecruiter posts your job to 200 plus job sites, including social media networks like Facebook and Twitter, all with a single click. You can find candidates in any city or industry nationwide. You post it once and just let the qualified candidates roll in. I find this fun because I actually have used ZipRecruiter as an applicant before, so I can speak to it from that end. And I think it's cool to do it from the employer side. And ZipRecruiter is making a pretty amazing offer here because you can post jobs to ZipRecruiter for free if you go to ZipRecruiter.com/sportsfan, S-P-O-R-T-S-F-A-N. And then you can post it for free. You get to, they send all the candidates to you. You can quickly screen them, rate them, and hire the right person fast. ZipRecruiter's been used by more than 1 million businesses. You can check it out for yourself. Again, the URL is ZipRecruiter.com/sportsfan. You can try it for free. You can post jobs for free. And hopefully you are incredibly impressed with the product that they provide. Now back to the conversation. Going back to Oklahoma City, I'm intrigued by the idea of how much of this dynamic that they have that is so well-worn and well-established, and they're settling into a spot. Kind of, and we'll see. I mean, they miss Adams a lot defensively for these couple games, but he'll be back after this concussion. And the idea of how much of this is necessary and how much of this is prescribed. And I'm legitimately unsure.
Yeah, I'm kind of 50-50 on it. Like I said earlier, I do think there are players on the Thunder who would have the potential to go and do things if they were given the shot. Maybe if you were to compare it to Houston too, like that would be a good way to look at it, because I think going into the season, the notion of both teams was that Harden and Westbrook would kind of have to just take the mantle and wouldn't have a lot to work with. But despite how similar their stats are, James Harden is a lot more privy to letting the ball go and letting other guys create. And as a result, you've got these players that you didn't necessarily think were players who are doing really, really great things for the Rockets. And, you know, it's kind of like, as far as the MVP debate goes, at least, it's kind of bitten him in the back a little bit, because now it's like, oh, yeah, James Harden has great teammates. And look, Russell Westbrook's just carrying this team.
It's a good point. And one of the greatest things about Mike D'Antoni's system is that it empowers and engages the players that are willing to embrace it. And that has been basically this entire Rockets team, whether it's the starters, like Pat Beverly has done a nice job with the ball in his hands a little bit less because everything's running through Harden. Ariza is having a great year. Clint Capella, when he's healthy, has been fantastic. And then the second unit, Montrezl Harrell, Sam Decker, like those guys have been great this season, and it is allowing the Rockets to play, incidentally, tying along with your point, one of the big disparities between Westbrook and Harden right now is that the Rockets have been a lot better with Harden on the bench than the Thunder have been with Westbrook on the bench. Some of that is personnel, but some of it is also system.
Right. I mean, that's not even getting into Eric Gordon, who is like, it's probably the closest award of the year, but he's my sixth man of the year for sure.
Certainly in the conversation between him and Lou, and I have trouble with this because Eric Gordon is absolutely a better player than Lou Williams, but Lou Williams early in the year was having a better year. I need to look at the numbers again. I mean, Nate and I will do an awards pod at the end of January at some point, but Gordon, whether he has that or not, has been absolutely spectacular this year, fitting exactly the role that they wanted, even though it's not where he started the year due to Beverly's injury.
Right, and even looking at somebody like Sam Decker, and a lot of this does, like, I'm glad you mentioned D'Antoni, because a lot of this does go to his system as well, but I'm not sure if somebody like Decker would have stuck out the way that he has in Houston, in Oklahoma.
He wouldn't. It wouldn't work in the same way, and the fact that their offense looks as good as it does when Harden is not on the floor, I mean, he makes a huge difference, but that they're still up there is a testament to Gordon, but also a testament to D'Antoni.
Yeah.
It helps, though, that they have two starting caliber players in Beverly and Gordon that are often playing together when Harden's sitting, but Houston is implementing something that I've wanted to see for years, often actually for me, more at power forward and center. The Hawks did it at the beginning of the year, which is if you have three good guards, just play them in a rotation where you just have two of them on the floor at any one time. Teams sometimes go to hockey subs a little bit too frequently, and D'Antoni has realized we have three good guys. We only ever really want to play two of them at once, so we can make this work.
Right, and that's a big reason there's such a huge disparity between Westbrook's on-off rating and Harden's on-off rating as well.
Samaje Christian was not exactly the same caliber as those guys.
Well, at least Cameron Payne's back, so
yeah,
there's that.
He is, and the Thunder will look, I think they'll look better with Payne out there just because he's so much more competent than what they had before. And Oladipo, as talented as he is, never really stepped into that role of being the kind of being an initiator on that second unit, paralleling Bradley Beal, actually. Two guys who were drafted in the same class, that one of the pieces of their appeal was that idea that maybe they could initiate second unit offense. Both of them probably aren't. That's not what they're going to do, but they've improved enough in the other elements of offense and overall team basketball to be around the same value level that many expected when they were drafted.
Yeah, I think both those guys are just too much of, at least they think of themselves as too much of natural scorers, and there's definitely a little bit of tunnel vision. They're not really combo guard types. They don't really have that skill set, but they're still a great, great asset to their teams in a lot of other ways, though.
Absolutely, and both play with individuals, happen to have fortunately gotten to play with individuals that shoulder the burden that they were quote-unquote supposed to be able to handle, so they're not really missing much. And I think what that relates to also is that while there are a lot of other ways to get an offense going, running pick and rolls at the NBA level with NBA defenders is incredibly complicated, and there are a lot of players that just can't shoulder that burden.
Yeah, that's certainly true. I think Beal's actually like a prime example of that because of how many years going back to
Randy Whitman.
Yeah, Whitman, there we go. his era in Washington, they used to try to get him set up in pick and rolls all the time. Like, they dedicated so much of their offense just to developing that in him. It never really got anywhere past a drive or a pull-up jumper.
That can be enough when you have the right player, but passing is so important out of that, especially if you can generate a little bit of extra attention. The idea of creating a pick and roll that requires more than two people to defend is still a centerpiece of a successful offense.
Right, and the beauty behind having the secondary ball handler running a pick and roll is to help ease off the predictability of most NBA offenses, and that's just not really something that somebody like Beal provides.
It's a great point. Also, the Wall Gortat pick and rolls are just so awesome that you can work off of that, and
right.
Gortat and Wall have this great chemistry that comes not only with experience but also off of a guy setting really good screens, which creates the space for Wall that he can use to do something. It's not always to shoot a jump shot. Sometimes it actually, the screen creates a space for a pass for Gortat. Sometimes it creates the need for help. And they're making it work despite Gortat has a little bit of a jumper, but not having that pick and pop threat. I mean, there's a lot of obsession, justifiably so, I'm not criticizing it in any way, about the value of a pick and pop big. But having a guy who sets really good screens and rolls hard to the basket is still a great way to generate points.
Right. He's also got the benefit of, I think, pretty much any big that played with Steve Nash, which is the ability to just be able to find space and, like, be savvy down low that way.
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, yeah, he really downplays the need for having a good jumper when you're able to, like, just trick the guy that you're defending into thinking that he's with you and just, like, slide behind him or, like, go a little bit above. And he's got, like, once you get him a little bit down low, if he's within 5 feet, he's savvy enough that he's going to make the right play.
Right. It does ask a lot of the passer, depending on how much space is created, because sometimes they have to get it through narrow windows. But you can use that. There are a lot of good passers in the NBA, so you can monopolize on, you, or you can capitalize on that. And I was thinking about it with Gortat, because Russell Westbrook's former teammate, Serge Ibaka, is not rolling to the rim anymore. He's almost exclusively pick and popping. And while he's good at that, it's a real nice benefit of how Ibaka has grown his game. I like the idea, when it's possible, of a player who can do both, because it just keeps the defense off balance.
Right. It's kind of depressing to see what has become of Ibaka in a lot of ways. As much as, you know, he has grown his game out, it's just kind of, like, I wonder how much he's popping just because he's developed that part of his game, and the other end could just be, you know, massive decline as well. It's really, really hard to say, especially on that Magic team where, you know, it's just hard to get a grasp on anything.
I have a series of different thoughts on Ibaka, all of which are depressing. But so he, like, last year throughout the regular season, it looked like he had lost a step, and that, you know, we were sitting there going, oh, he's going to be a free agent in a little over a year. He doesn't look like he's probably on the physical decline. And then in the playoffs, in both the Spurs series, and then I would say especially in the Warriors series, because that's when they were able to play him at center, he didn't look like his old self, but he looked like a middle ground between what he was in that season and prior. And so you're sitting there going, oh man, if he can be that for X amount of time, that's great. You know, he can do that, and ideally he can do that playing center, stretch out the floor. And then not only has he not shown that in Orlando, but even the lower end of the defensive impact that he was having in OKC is largely gone as well.
Yeah, and you do wonder how much of that is like a result of being on a team that doesn't have much of a playoff shot too. But, you know, at this point, it just seems like he really isn't the player he used to be. That could be another matter of speculation. It could be injuries. It could be because he's a lot older than we think he is. Not quite sure in that sense. But, you know, he just, like, there are nights where he just gets completely lit up in one-on-one matches too. So it's just, you know, he's lost pretty much every aspect of his defensive ability.
I wonder not what his value is going to be, because teams will pay for his skill set, even if it's largely,
you know, theoretical.
Yeah, his theoretical skill set is just so valuable. But I don't know if he has that place, that rock solid place, as being an important player on a good to great team, which is what I always enjoyed him most doing. Like, he obviously in his prime, he was more than that. But he fits so well as a cog in the machine because he was versatile defensively, offensively, kind of balanced the low usage, high efficiency, mm-hmm. depending on the circumstance. And now, if you think about, if you were to give him a lined up starting spot on, let's say, the Raptors, but really whoever, I don't know that I'm super comfortable with that, especially considering what he's probably going to get paid this summer.
Right. I mean, that's the thing. Like, I don't know if the Raptors are kind of one of the perfect teams for him to go to, because they're in the phase of contention where it's kind of like, well, you're not really going to beat the Cavs unless something breaks your way. So maybe you do take a risk on somebody like Ibaka. But at the same time, he's kind of in that place, I think, right now, where if he was to completely just fall off the map, that wouldn't shock me. But at the same time, if he was going to, like, go to a contender and make not a full resurgence, that would really surprise me. But, like, be 80% of what he was, that wouldn't be completely shocking either. It's just, he's just somebody that's really, really hard to put a finger on right now. Yeah, that does make him intriguing for a lot of the semi-contenders out there, though.
Right. Yeah, I've thought about him, not saying because of their personnel that he would be a great fit, but a team in the same situation as, like, the Wizards or the Bulls, where they're not contenders in that way, but he would probably make them better, even if it's not a perfect fit.
Right. Like, maybe the Wizards. I think the Bulls have taken their fair share of risks on guys that may or may not be good anymore, and, you know, it just hasn't paid off for them, so they might just want to call it at this point.
It feels like that's a part of the Bulls' DNA at this point. You know, I mean, not like it is for the Knicks. Holy crap. But the Bulls are, I had this weird realization a couple days ago when they were having success, as they have for the last couple weeks, with Jimmy Butler and floor spacing, which is not entirely surprising. But my question was not, oh, wow, like, this is working. It was, will the people who are making decisions for this team take this knowledge and turn it in and use it this offseason to make a team around Jimmy Butler?
Well, I think that's hypothetically what they tried to do last year. But, I mean, they just keep putting themselves in situations where it's stopgap after stopgap. And they really, really just need to take one season where it's the idea is one step back and two steps forward. Because as much as, like, I really hate the Jimmy Butler trade ideas, because he's the guy that you hope you get when you're rebuilding, and you've got him locked down for a couple of years here. So you got to just waste 1 year so you can make the last 2 years really good, I think. Because, like, I don't know if you guys have talked about, like, the trade proposals for him, but at the end of the day, like, if it was me, if I'm not getting back, like, 3 top 5 lottery picks, I'm not even thinking about it.
I'm not quite that high, but I agree with your premise. Your premise is that when you get a lottery pick, your dream is to get somebody as good as Jimmy Butler. Jimmy Butler deserves to start in the All-Star game in a strong East starter conversation. Not as strong as the West, but still very strong. And there is no guarantee, even if you get the number one pick, number one pick is pretty strong, but there's no guarantee that guy is going to become Jimmy Butler. He's a very actualized version of an incredibly talented guy, even though he went late in the first round. And Butler, not only is he under a reasonable contract right now because he's one of those players who signed before things got completely out of hand, but the Bulls in particular have the advantage because they can sign him to, assuming he qualifies, to this designated veteran extension at some point where nobody else can make him that offer. You know, before he hits the open market, they can lock him up to a rate that not only is he eliminating the risk, but he's also creating more value than could ever be there any other way.
Right. And when I said 3 first-round picks, the idea, or top 5 lottery picks, the idea wasn't all those players would permeate into one, but you would hope that, you know, after enough trial and error with 3 picks, that one of those guys are like, they would all combine to be worth what Jimmy Butler is worth right now. And like you said, with salary, like, you got to love that he's right now the second highest player on the team. And the chances are that they pretty much got him locked up. I mean, I don't know anybody who would leave that much money on the table at the end of the day, especially in a market like Chicago. I mean, I get the players don't really go there, but it is a huge, huge market. And unless, like, you know, a team like maybe LA or something like hops in, I just don't see what's going to be more alluring to somebody like Jimmy Butler. So they've really, really just got to work off the premise that they've got him and they're keeping him, and then just, like, I think it's time for a fire sale there, honestly.
I agree with, like, you. It's the same basic logic that I talked a little bit on Dunked On this past week about what I would do for if I were running the Knicks. And the idea is basically that both the Knicks and the Bulls have, at very different points in their career, incredibly talented players that, reasonably speaking, are going to be the best players on their franchises for years to come. You know, they're not the best players in the league, but they're top 20 overall, and they're going to be better for the next couple of years, maybe even than they are right now. So both of those situations, the teams didn't really take that into account. In the Bulls' case, that was more due to circumstance because, you know, Rondo became available, they didn't have a point guard.
Right.
Wade became available, and it's Dwayne Wade. The Knicks just screwed it up. They misidentified talent. They built maybe arguably more around Carmelo Anthony, despite not appeasing Carmelo Anthony. And so the idea behind what I would be doing right now, starting today, if I were running either of those teams, is see how much you can do to get a reset. And the Bulls have a much easier time of this than the Knicks do because they didn't make any bad long-term contracts. So
right.
they can make all that work.
Right. And, like, so when you look at the guys that they should get rid of, at least, like, the high-value guys, I think you're pretty much strapped with Rondo. I don't think anybody's – I mean, I don't know. I keep thinking nobody's going to take Rondo, but then a team ends up taking Rondo. Unfortunately, Sacramento's already had him. Otherwise, he'd be a pretty perfect option for a team that you could unload him onto. But Taj Gibson, is there a contender, a semi-contender in the league that wouldn't take a rental on him for a first-round pick? I mean, Kyle Korver got a first-round pick. You might even be able to get, like, a first and a second or something for him.
Or a first and a low-end kind of, like, lottery ticket young guy. You know, like, one of those players where there's a 1 in 10 chance they end up being good, but that 1 in 10 chance is still a useful way to use a roster spot. You know, like,
Jerian Grant.
Yeah, something of that ilk. And Taj Gibson can certainly help. Also, a great example of a player who is very well-liked around the league, and well-liked players often get more in a trade than you'd expect, just by virtue of that. To people like Thibodeau, who I'm sure Tibbs would have loved to have had him all year this year for the Wolves, but
yeah, and I think if the Wolves were actually going for a playoff spot, that'd be a perfect destination for him. I think if the Clippers were legally able to do this, I think you could probably get 2 first rounders for him out of them.
Yeah, it's just a complicated circumstance in terms of where they want to send all these pieces, but that's what being a GM is. You listen to all of these offers, you see what the best option on the table is, and also identifying who is the best and like worst case kind of scenario for your team. So like Robin Lopez is a good basketball player, but do they need him as a part of the next great Bulls team? I lean towards no. So I don't think you have to trade him, but you listen. And if you find a good deal, then you take it. And whatever the assets are that you get back, you get that. Taj is a clear issue because he's probably not, you're probably not going to want to re-sign him. So then you make the move now. And I think Wade, you kind of ask him what he wants to do and you work from there. If he's happy or down to be traded, then if you can, if you think it's a net positive trade for you, then you do it. And then figuring out with Mirotić, if you want to bring him back at the expected value, then you probably keep him. And if you are uncomfortable with that, maybe you consider moving him too.
I'd probably part ways with Mirotić. I don't think you'd want to pay him like a real NBA contract on a rookie salary. He's not so bad, but he's like, I don't know if he's a long-term piece for any contender really. And that's, if you're going to tear down, I think that's really what you got to be thinking about.
On the Bulls, who would you say, other than Jimmy, obviously, who would you say you would be more likely than not to want to have long-term? It always depends on the offer, but and what theoretically some of them will get in free agency. But who do you look at on the team and say, yeah, this is somebody, whatever happens with fire sale, these are the ones that we'd want to keep? For me, Cristiano Felicio is probably there.
Yeah, that's the only guy I was really thinking. I like what Paul Zipser has shown. He's on like a dirt cheap contract, so I'd probably keep him, of course. And then
I like McDermott too.
Yeah. McDermott was a guy I was kind of thinking about, and again, he's locked up as well. So why don't you keep him either? And he's also like, he's a guy that's improved every year. He's especially now. I love what he's doing in the post, and he's definitely growing into his game as a player. He's kind of, there are nights where he's like Dougie Buckets, like the guy that you watched play college basketball. So I think, you know, yeah, I definitely keep him around just because he's on a rookie deal, and he's also really tight with Jimmy. They go work out every year together, so if you want to keep Jimmy happy, you might want to keep his best friend on the team on, especially if you're trading his other good friend, Taj Gibson.
They're both Midwestern guys too. I'm sure that helps a little bit. But before we continue with the podcast, I want to take a quick moment to tell you about our friends at Audible. Audible is offering Real GM Radio listeners a free audiobook with a 30-day trial membership. You just go to audible.com/try now and you can browse their unparalleled selection of audiobooks, original audio shows, news, comedy, and so much more from some of the leading audiobook publishers, broadcasters, entertainers, and so much more. One of my personal favorites is comedy because it's really great material, and it's often narrated, especially in Audible's case, by the person who actually wrote it. So these are talented comedians like Jim Gaffigan, Tina Fey, the late, great George Carlin, and it's them doing their own material, so it's really great. But you don't have to take my word for it. They have a wealth of other options, depending on what you're interested in. And they have a great selection of kids' books, including the whole Harry Potter series and Charlotte's Web. But really, any genre you're interested in, they have a great selection. And audiobooks are a great way to kind of fit in with the rest of your life, because it can be more persistent. It can be just a part of everything else, whether that be on your commute or doing daily activities, or, you know, if you're doing housework or anything like that, and that you can continue on with the story is a really, really great thing. So if you're interested in this, you can check out their amazing selection. You go to audible.com/try now. That's TRYNOW. And you get a free audiobook with a 30-day trial membership, so you can see for yourself. Now back to the show. I was going to ask you, just as somebody watching the league, what teams have intrigued you the most? Like, who do you find yourself watching and thinking about this year?
I guess if we're going to frame it as like the teams I like watching the most, the Bucks, obviously. Giannis is probably the best ticket in the league right now, especially for league pass games. The Warriors, of course, they're pretty much can't miss. Yeah, those are like my big two. I really have enjoyed watching Houston. I think I've made that pretty clear talking about Harden earlier. I fall pretty strongly on the Harden side of the MVP debate between those guys. Other than that, kept an eye on the Timberwolves, just hoping they'd be better than they are. But I mean, and regardless of whether they are, they're still like as frustrating as they are. They're a young team. they're still really fun to watch at times. Always keeping an eye on the Raptors as well.
I would also add in, all those teams are good, two other kind of groups. One, I found myself very intrigued this year by some of the really talented players that are in weird situations. So like John Wall, or especially earlier in the year before the Wizards figured it out, I was watching even more of them. They've been a lot better recently. Pelicans with AD, they've been figuring it out when he's at center. But the other big one for me over the last 2 weeks has been the Sixers. The Sixers are this remarkable combination because there were these inklings earlier in the year that's like, hey, like they have some players that are better, and just replacing horrendous non-NBA talent with NBA players is going to help. But I legitimately did not see any of this coming, and it could be an aberration. It probably is. But the last 2 weeks, they've been my favorite team to watch in the league.
Yeah, and especially coming off last night's game, which was just, you know, it was great to watch in so many ways. Of course, the highlight is going to be Embiid's block on Kyle Lowry, native son of Philadelphia, at the end of the day. But yeah, I definitely agree with you. I should have put them on my list. They've kind of gone from the team that I used to watch for like 22 minutes a night when Embiid was playing to like, I still probably only watch them when Embiid's playing, but I'll go and watch the other 48 too. I'm not necessarily hitting skip or like changing to another game or anything like that. They've been a lot more fun to watch as of late. I really, really, even from the start, like from the start of the season, I really, really enjoy watching Sarge play. He's a lot of fun. He's got like the perfect traits of like the European player in that he's like super, I mean, he's not super unconventional, but like there's like kind of a dissonance to his game that I really like. It's like a little bit surprising sometimes, like the passes he's going to fire off, stuff like that.
I enjoy the Raptors sometimes too, but I enjoy the Sixers also because they have a lot of players that don't do the negative things that really frustrate me. This actually was what I was thinking about with the Raptors, of like taking bad twos or, you know, getting bogged down. I mean, they still have some weird crunch time stuff because they basically always will. This is a super young team that hasn't done much of that, but they've been better recently than they were earlier in the year. And so having players like Gerald Henderson, who is a competent pro, every once in a while he has a really cool highlight because he has that, brings back that athleticism a little bit. But Sergio Rodriguez, other than being bad defensively, just produces good offense. McConnell's been good. Covington going from being the three part of 3-and-D to the D part of 3-and-D without ever being both is captivating to me. And they have a lot of interesting guys, and I'm a huge Nerlens fan, have been since he was at Kentucky, really since high school, actually. And this isn't the best version of him, we're still working on our way, but every once in a while he does something that just takes your breath away, because even though I've watched the league obsessively, have for years, he is physically capable of doing things that other people in this league cannot do.
Right. And I know it's not going to be a good long-term solution just because of the way that the league is going, or maybe it would be a good zag, although, you know, I don't know how much I really believe in that, but I'm ready to see them on the floor together and beat and Noel a lot more. Like, you just, you know, throw it out there. You're not going to make the playoffs. These are two of your best prospects. It could be just devastating defensively. You're not going to space. Well, Embiid does space the floor. He's not really going to be able to post up down low that much with Noel out there. But, you know, I definitely think we need to see it happen a lot more just to see potentially the defensive ability is devastating enough that it's somewhat tenable.
Right. The idea that the term that I've used before, I think I talked about this on a podcast with Sam Vecenie a few months ago, is the idea of a stagger plus. So the idea of a stagger plus is that you want to keep the players separate as much as you can, but they're both so good that they're going to need to play together to get them to the right minutes total. And those guys will probably be pretty good in that, at least better than Noel and Okafor were, or Embiid and Okafor were, because their games just didn't mesh.
Right, and I think it's been a debate pretty much throughout the season, but I think it's kind of becoming clear that Okafor is going to end up being the man out in that situation. What do you think?
He definitely makes the most sense as the odd man out. The circumstances dictated a little bit differently just because we don't know what's going to happen with Noel. He's a restricted free agent. He could get paid a lot of money. But at the same time, I think what the Sixers should probably do is listen to offers on both of them and be willing to trade. You have to trade at least one of them just because there's no point in keeping all three. But I would also be open to, depending on what the offers are for Nerlens, to trading both and just realizing that you have Embiid, you have your franchise center. Yes, there is the risk of injury, but you can use those other assets to procure another good team around them and use one of your draft pieces to get a backup who can eventually be maybe a better version or a version of like what you wanted from Okafor but haven't yet gotten.
Right. Like that, like I definitely like that idea. And I think like it just another thing, like when we talk about the Sixers that you got to as well, is that you can't really think about anybody except for Embiid as more than expendable. Like a lot of these guys can be packaged into something else for sure. The one place I really worry about is because we haven't really seen too much out of the new Sixers management yet, but they really just, they need to get over the fact that, no, and I'm glad they're playing him again finally, but they got to get over the fact that he was upset. That's the collateral damage of doing what you did. Somebody good is going to be upset over it.
Right.
Like that's just, you shouldn't have been so openly tanking if you didn't want to have one of the most competitive people in the world be upset at you. That was like, that was going to happen. You have to deal with the ramifications of that, especially now that it's a new organization too. It just doesn't really, when I think about restricted free agency and even now how they're not really like testing them out together, like I kind of feel like that's still some leftover resentment from that.
It very well could be. And the benefit of waiting with him is that there is always the possibility that he gets a little bit undervalued just because the other player, like, there is a risk to waiting on your money with Nerlens if you expect that the Sixers might match, if they're intimidated, because there's no benefit gain there. So if he has to wait out the market a little bit, this is much narrower than last year in terms of number of teams, but the arguably the more important part here is that it's narrower in terms of how many teams have enough space to make a player like Nerlens an offer. So there could be one or two that are more in that kind of YOLO spot where, hey, we have this money, we struck out on our best guys, so why not? But there is a distinct possibility. I haven't run the numbers yet because I'm waiting for the new CBA to put in all the new stuff into my Excel. But off the top of my head and from the other research I've done, there's a very real chance that Universe could be one or two teams, and who knows, maybe they're not the biggest fan of Nerlens, and then the Sixers can get him back at a reasonable price.
Yeah, that's a good point. I mean, if anything, like all they've done this season is drive down his value anyway, right? So
that's true. At the end of the day. I've been asking people this for a couple weeks now. I asked our mutual friend Ben Golliver last week, is there anywhere with like Nerlens or let's say any of the other potential trade targets that any fit that you think is great, like, oh, I would love to see X player on X team?
It's more than anything. There's Millsap in Toronto that's like the homer pick, of course, but for Noel, I'd say probably Portland, which I'm assuming, since it was Ben, you guys probably dove pretty deep into that.
Of course. But yeah, I would just like to see a few. There are some players that are just in tougher situations, and I would love to see them somewhere else. Ben McLemore is a great example of this. So McLemore is on the Kings. They're not really doing much with him. He is another example of a player who could be really hurt by the restricted free agency process, assuming the Kings make a qualifying offer on him, which I expect that they will. And I would love to see him somewhere else, really anywhere else, to be honest.
Right.
And also, an underlying part of this, but the problem is they don't have matching salary, especially if Middleton comes back. If the Blazers can somehow pull, using their first round pick plus something else that isn't one of their best players, into getting a better option at center than the ones they have right now, I would be over the moon happy.
Right. Just as an aside, when I read that Middleton might be back before the playoffs start, I might have thrown a five on them winning the Eastern Conference Finals. And for anybody in a country where betting on sports is legal, or a state, I'm not really sure how it works in the States, the odds are 46. So, you know, you might want to get in on that before they change.
That would be a very satisfying bet to win. I mean, the Cavs are great, not saying anything.
Yeah, no, it's a good future. I mean, it's not, the odds are 46. There's a reason they're at that. But, absolutely. You know, I think if with Middleton back, that kind of gives them a puncher's chance, especially if something happens. Because then I think with Middleton back and with Giannis's growth, like, they have a shot at kind of being the second best team in the East, and also a matchup nightmare that won't have been scouted that well up until that point either.
At this point, really, all I want is for, I would love for Cleveland to get two tough series, but if it's one and it's just that conference finals against the Bucks or the Celtics, I think the Celtics could give them a decent series. I would just be so happy.
Yeah, that'd be, Middleton does come back. I mean, they are, I would already peg them at probably winning a series, right?
But yeah, if he comes,
if he comes back, they have an honest to God shot at the Eastern Conference finals, I think. It depends on, you know, how fast he acclimates and who knows how rusty he's going to be. But, I mean, they weren't even supposed to be here to cop LeBron James a little bit, who, you know, they might be a problem for him coming up.
When a player of high caliber comes back, one of the other things you want to look at is the quality of the player he's replacing. And Tony Snell has not done a lot to move the needle. So not only are you, this was true with the Celtics this year. So the Celtics looked shaky at the beginning of the year. And not only did they get Al Horford and then Jay Crowder back at the same day, actually, they replaced worse guys in the rotation. And so all of a sudden, Tyler Zeller went from playing a lot to barely playing at all. And that can be almost as huge in the right circumstance.
Right, yeah, that's a really good point. He's not making anything happen for them there. So, I mean, just subtracting his minutes alone is going to be a huge help for them.
All of a sudden, they go to an area where you get an outright majority of their minutes going to above average NBA starters.
Yeah, yeah.
Center problems, you still have that. And then you move Tony Snell into a role that actually makes sense with him. I don't know if they would want to go to a true second unit or how they would want to do that, but at least they would have so much more talent to work with.
Yeah, I still think, you know, staggering would be the best option for them. Just like I would never do hockey subs on a team like that, especially if you bring Middleton back, you're going to have two really, really good creators that are going to have to learn how to, you know, share a little bit as well. So, I mean, that would pretty much be ideal, actually, because it would just bolster their bench so much, too.
Yeah. I'm also excited to see how they handle the dynamics with Matthew Dellavedova, signed a big contract there, 4-year contract as a free agent, and has broadly been outplayed by Malcolm Brogdon. Whether that continues or not, we actively don't know, but that can be complicated. I think Deli's okay with it, but I want to see how that works out and how much that helps them just having two players that can capably fill that role.
Well, you know Deli, he can just fit into any situation. He doesn't really care about having the credit or anything. He's just going to go out there and play, you know, he's a grinder.
Well, and they're winning. You know, like, it's a lot easier to do that and to take that demoted role when your team is doing incredibly well, whereas, like, what happened in Orlando, where in Orlando they demoted Elfrid Payton and Vooch, though they ended up playing plenty of minutes. You know, it was a very different circumstance. But when your team is not out of the playoff picture, but on the very, very fringes of the playoff picture, it's a lot different than when you're outperforming expectations and being awesome.
Right. Well, I was actually just trying to make a joke about grit and you know, how Deli's the best teammate. But you do make good points, especially, you know, for a player like Dellavedova, he doesn't have a leg to stand on if he wants to start complaining about his playing time. He's obviously being outplayed and by a player who is far more closer to the timeline that the Bucks want to be on, too. So, you know, even if he was somebody that was inclined to complain, and like I joked earlier, but he doesn't seem like he is, he really, like, where's he going to go? What's his argument, right?
And we know he's a champion, so he has a champion's heart and a champion's mentality.
Yeah, yeah, he really brings that pedigree to the team. So I do think that especially the emergence of Brogdon kind of does, especially if Middleton does come back, it kind of maybe could have a too many cooks effect, and maybe just as a precautionary idea too, it could be a good idea to start bringing Middleton off of the bench and just like in lower minutes when he's coming back. Of course, like, you know, he hasn't played basketball in quite a long time, so like just could be a good idea anyway. And then moving on from there, I'm sure, you know, it'd be a good idea to eventually get him in the starting lineup and maybe have Brogdon running the show in the second unit. But just it might be a good idea to see how that goes with him as a sixth man running things with Deli as more of like a secondary playmaker. And there's a ton of spacing on the second unit for them, too. So it could be kind of fun to see how that goes and then just let Giannis run things as a starter.
A lot of different ways to make it work, and you're right that they probably will want to bring Middleton along slowly, also because it's a hamstring injury, and hamstring injuries are notoriously terrifying for re-injury. And especially with his horrifying one, which I still will not repeat the specifics of, but if you want to look into it, you can, but it was gross. And I'm excited to see the Bucks, because whenever a team completely blows through expectations and then has a change that's involved, you get a different sense of their viability and what they're going to be long-term. So I'm really pumped about what they're going to be. And another team that is going through a change, I wouldn't say they've outperformed expectations, but I'm just really excited to watch them the rest of the year, is the Utah Jazz, because the Jazz have been good, but they haven't been full strength for very much of this year.
Yeah. I mean, the Jazz really get me thinking about, especially given their health issues, and I think the Celtics kind of fall along the same lines, they've kind of gotten me thinking about the viability of these teams that, you know, run based on all the key cogs in the unit working, which is not necessarily the Jazz. I think Gobert and Hayward have definitely, like, they're definitely the best players on the team, and they stand out from the pack. If you don't have Gobert, I don't really know. Like, they have strong defensive talent, but I don't really know what happens to him defensively. He anchors the whole unit. I mean, he's fantastic defensively. He's grown on both ends, but, you know, I think he's my defensive player of the year so far. Draymond has a puncher's chance, I guess, but he's just doing everything out there. Like, it's just impossible to get into the paint when he's playing. And it gives everybody else more freedom to go out and pressure, too. So I think, you know, those two are definitely the standouts. But, you know, when you keep losing guys to ticky-tack injuries and stuff, I think, like, Hill's probably the best example of this because of how much better they are with him, even though he's been hobbled for part of the season with, like, more smaller stuff. But regardless, you know, they have been missing somebody at any point. Like, it got me thinking about the viability of contenders like this, because at the end of the day, like, it's kind of a give and take. The more players that you rely on, the higher the chance an injury could set a season into not necessarily turmoil, especially not for the Jazz, but at least, like, keep them from reaching their ceiling, especially if they're trying to contend. But then on the other hand, you might have a team where the extreme example would be the Cavs if LeBron got hurt, right? But even seeing how that really hasn't happened doesn't, like, seem like it's going to happen because of LeBron's durability. But maybe another team that relies on their stars a lot, maybe, like, Curry even being a little bit hobbled in the finals last year had a huge impact on the Warriors. But that's just one of the things that the Jazz have gotten me thinking about, like, how, especially with the way the injuries have gone up in the past few years too, just how much can you really rely on everybody being healthy at the right time?
It's a great point, and also gets to the idea, which I might talk about more than other people just because I really like it as a concept, which is defining success. Like, there's a reason why teams with MVP caliber players win championships almost every single time, and it's because that becomes a defining point when you get to crunch time. And I mean, the Jazz last year famously missed the playoffs because they were just so horrendous without point guards in crunch time. George Hill presumably will help that quite a bit, and he has when he's actually been on the floor. But those compilations of almost stars broadly haven't done well on that stage, but they can get you basically all the way there. They can get you to, you know, conference finals and everything like that. And considering where Utah has been and considering how hard it is to get an MVP caliber player, if they can make the conference finals, maybe not this year, but next year, I'd say, like the Raptors, that's a great step. That's a nice place to be as a franchise.
Oh, yeah, I wouldn't, you know, decry anything they've done. I don't think there's anything wrong with the way they've built their team. If anything, you know, they're showing that there's other ways to do it. But, you know, it just kind of shows that, you know, every different method of team building has its setbacks. And I think we're starting to see that now with more teams that are built with lower end stars. But, you know, at the end of the day, yeah, they have to be happy with their season. And only one team wins a championship. And there are a plethora of reasons why that's the case. So, you know, it's not like there's anything wrong with what the Jazz are doing.
Yeah, that's a fair way of putting it. Before we move on, I want to take a little bit of time to talk about Blue Apron, the fantastic food delivery service. For those of you who have listened to Real Jam Radio before, you know that I am a huge fan of Blue Apron, have been for a long time. And a good example of that is a meal that's coming up for me this coming week. I'm excited about it when you get to pick things ahead of time. They have hoisin chicken steam buns, and I've never made anything like that. I've eaten plenty like that, and so it's exciting to learn how to make something that I enjoyed eating and that, you know, the ingredients are going to be incredibly high quality. That's one of the staples of Blue Apron, is that the ingredients are absolutely incredible, and you get to have it in perfect proportions. Everything's all seasoned and measured out, and you get to put it together and gain the confidence to make it. You get to eat a great meal, and none of the real the downside, no issues with food waste. A lot of times if you're going to the grocery store and you want to buy some of the spices and everything else, you have to overbuy in order to make it work. Sometimes those things can sit on your shelf for a while. And with Blue Apron, it's all self-contained. It's all excellent. And you don't have to take my word for it. You can check it out. Go to blueapron.com/realgm, just like the name of this podcast. And you get 3 meals for free, including free shipping, on your first order. So you can try it out. I've been on Blue Apron for, I think it's close to a year now. Such a huge fan of what they do. And the seafood is great. Basically everything is great. And you can find meals that tickle your fancy, either from a cooking perspective, eating perspective, ideally both. And you can try it for yourself. Again, it's blueapron.com/realgm. R-E-A-L-G-M. Now back to the show. What else are you, is there anything else that you're interested in seeing the rest, let's say before the trade deadline and then for the rest of the regular season?
Well, yeah, we've talked about the Bucks enough for sure, but you know, they're one of the teams that I'm most excited to see what happens with them. I kind of want to see if Denver can start putting some things together too. Mm-hmm. They're starting to get there. I love watching Jokic play. Moutier is a guy that I kind of, earlier this season, especially with the emergence of Jamal Murray, I started to give up on him, and now he's I'm kind of starting to eat crow for it now too, like right around the time that I was like, no, it's not gonna happen for him anymore. But you know, it's really nice to see things starting to come together there a little bit more for them. And just with the way that the West is right now, there's an opening to make the playoffs. I'd like to see if they could kind of slip into it.
I would too. There are two teams in the NBA that could really upset the apple cart in a good way at the trade deadline. One of them is Atlanta, because they have Paul Millsap and other guys theoretically like Thabo and really whoever else they wanted to move. They could go in a lot of different directions. And then the Nuggets, because the Nuggets have Wilson Chandler, Danilo Gallinari, both of whom are great players but don't necessarily fit in with the timeline. And Denver having some success, especially if the Kings end up falling off due to Rudy Gay's injury, unfortunate injury, there might be a little bit of an opening there. So how those two teams approach the next month and how they approach the trade deadline will be important not only for them but for the rest of the league, because they are the pathway for a team to reach a new level of relevance and danger in the playoffs.
Yeah, definitely. And I think right now, especially with Gay's injury, it seems like it's going to be a three-way race: the Nuggets, Blazers, and Pelicans. Right now the Nuggets have the eighth seed, but you know, they also, all those teams have a pretty bad record, so they are going to have to, you know, keep up with whatever they're doing. And it's just the thing with the Nuggets that I think about a lot is, because this kind of goes back to the start of the season, but because so much of what they could be is theoretical, like in a trade scenario, I kind of think, like, what do they really need? Like, do they package Gallo and Wilson for like an upper tier swing man? Is that like what they're kind of going for? Like, I don't really, the only things that are set in stone, I think, are like, you got Murray and Jokic for sure, and Moutier seems like he's gonna come along and make good on some stuff. So it's hard to envision a future. That's kind of why I avoided the trade deadline question with them.
That's why.
If you have any ideas.
They can go in a lot of different directions, and it always, and I know that this is frustrating, it depends on the offers that you get. They could go with draft picks, they could go with young, more established players. The other guy that aligns with all this is Will Barton. Will Barton is a wonderful player on one of the league's best contracts, but he'll also be an unrestricted free agent after next year. So if a team wants to make you a ludicrous offer for him, especially if they see Jamal Murray as a two, or they intend on keeping Gary Harris, which they certainly could, then, well, why not move him for the right offer? So all of those things run together. Consolidation, if they could pull it off, would be fantastic. Mm-hmm. The problem there is, teams generally don't do that. You know, that's not the way, that's not the way that trades often work, but they should certainly be trying to do it if they can pull it off. I, for the life of me, can't think of a young player who is clearly good but might be in the wrong circumstance, who's maybe like buried. Like, this is what Andrew Wiggins could have been if he'd stayed on the Cavs. You know, like a guy who's good but kind of unnecessary on his team. Those players don't really exist, except if somebody feels that way about Jaylen Brown. But broadly speaking, the Celtics are in a very different place, and I can't imagine them doing it. So I'm sure the Nuggets would love that if the opportunity was there, but I'm openly skeptical about it. Then again, you never know. Like I fall back a lot on the Serge Ibaka trade because parts of it came out of nowhere for me. The biggest thing that came out of nowhere was not the trade partner. It was the price that they paid. So you never know. If a team overvalues your asset, you have to take it.
Yeah, that's true. That's what, you know, I didn't mention Gary Harris in the core because I really like Gary Harris. I think he's I think that they should keep him if they don't get like a good offer for him and then bring Jamal Murray off the bench is like the spark plug guy. He's kind of like the classic six man type. But yeah, like I think maybe Wiggins could still potentially be that guy. I don't think it's necessarily like it's not like anything in Minnesota is set in stone, and I don't think it should be with the way that they're playing. I don't know what necessarily they would want back, but if I think the conversation there is kind of like who you keep out of LaVine and Wiggins and. For the sake of entertaining this Nuggets thing, I would let's say they decide on letting go of Wiggins. Although I would part way with LaVine faster than I would with Wiggins if I was them. I mean, is there anything the Nuggets could potentially give them that they would want?
Gallinari would be awesome there if you were willing to re-sign.
Mm-hmm.
That would be a piece. Also, just to like if Will Barton would be. A useful piece for them, just like as kind of a filler in that way, but a younger guy who can improve and who they would have a chance to sign.
I do prefer Barton there, just because I don't like putting more pressure on the Wolves' win now thing. Because I mean, they're clearly crumbling under in the first place.
Depending on how they see all their guys, Nurkic would be useful for the Wolves just as a body. You know, he's not as useful there as for other places just because they just paid a bunch of money to Jang. But at the same point, if you're getting him in compensation for that, not only could you keep him and use him as a rotation player, but somebody else would be interested in him too.
Yeah, I mean, he would definitely be a good asset to have. I also agree with that because I'm not super high on Jang, especially the way that he fits with Karl Towns. I don't like that combination down low.
Gallo on the Wolves would be awesome. He's basically what they wanted Bielitsa to be, except a little bit less athletic.
Right.
Oh, so many fun fake trades. So many fun fake trades. Yeah, and I think the other part of the teams that can kind of change the conversation is whether a team like Minnesota just decides they don't want somebody they have and makes another move. And this gets into an idea that I haven't talked about anywhere yet, but I've been thinking about, which is if Ricky Rubio really hit the market, some of the teams that I think would be the most logical to consider acquiring him are actually teams that have a point guard right now, but that point guard is not locked in. So, for example, not the best example, but I still want to use it. Let's say Indiana wasn't totally sure that Jeff Teague was going to come back or that they were going to be able to get him at a reasonable price. If the Wolves weren't asking for the moon for Ricky Rubio, they don't have a ton of assets, but they do have their own first-round pick and they have some other young guys that are intriguing. Why not give him a call?
Yeah, I guess it depends on what you get back for him there. I don't know if I really like what he does to the spacing, though.
No, that's true.
I mean,
that's true. But I think the long-term vision there, if you were to get Rubio, would be, first of all, you're probably going to stagger him with Paul George and let the two of them have the ball in their hands kind of a lot, and also eventually get more floor spacing from the four. But that's done an all right job, so they could use him, but eventually maybe turn one of your other resources in that direction.
Yeah, certainly. As a long-term Especially if you don't think Teague's going to come back or
reasonable. And you could argue the same logic with, again, you have this floor spacing issue, with New Orleans. Like, if for whatever reason they thought Jrue Holiday wasn't going to come back, I would be calling about Ricky Rubio too, because they're not going to get somebody on the free agent market at that price who's that good. And so those are the teams, and that's also the exact reason why I probably wouldn't move Rubio right now. And it's the same thing I've said about Goran Dragic, is that there will be teams, especially assuming Curry and Chris Paul return to their current cities, there are going to be teams that have cap space that have a desperate need for a point guard. So if any one of the guys that is already on a team goes somewhere else, that team all of a sudden becomes a huge buyer.
Yeah, that's a really good point. I think it makes things especially interesting for the Pelicans too, because I mean, Jrue is probably number one target for anybody who needs a point guard, because he's the one guy that's most susceptible to leaving. I also think that the Pelicans need to do whatever they can to keep him. I'm somebody who's really, really high on Jrue. I think he's kind of just exactly the player you'd want if you want to contend for a championship. He's not necessarily like the number two, but he's like a really, really solid player who can do pretty much everything. There's nothing that he leaves off of the table. So, and that's also another reason why he could leave. But yeah, if I'm the Pelicans, I'm just like, I'm throwing everything I can into keeping him.
Drew also fits really well with a ball dominant player. So
he
fits so many places because you can make it work. Even though they don't have a ball dom, well, they do right now, but I would love him signing with the Knicks and basically just kind of clearing out a lot of the other stuff and saying, okay, we need to figure out what we're going to do at the two and the three long term, because Melo is going to be expiring after next year. They could theoretically move Courtney Lee, but a base of Drew and Porzingis, because Drew is younger, even though he has some weird injury history, that you could totally make that work and then throw all of your other remaining resources at figuring out what you want to do with the other big man spot and then the perimeter.
He is younger, but he has logged quite a few minutes, though, at the same time. He's like an old young.
He was the youngest guy in the league when he came in, and he's basically played heavy minutes ever since. I think he had a little bit of time where he was on the bench in Philly, but not that much. And then he was a starter for them, you know, was kind of in that all-star consideration. And then when he went to the Pelicans, as long as he's been healthy, he's been logging serious minutes.
Yeah, for sure. I kind of like the idea of Drew with maybe like a dual point guard lineup, or just with another guard who is also a creator. I think he's a guy that really needs to be, his skill set needs to be taken more advantage of as far as lineup creativity, because he's definitely strong enough and good enough to be defending twos, I think, for the most part. And especially when you consider so many teams are playing dual point guard lineups in the first place. I know we haven't exactly seen that work in Portland, but Portland also doesn't have anything down low that is as good as Anthony Davis, or really anything down low at all. So they're just over reliant on it. But I think, you know, it'd be a good idea, I think, if the Pelicans kind of opened up the floor to considering, like, let's not just like try to come up with like a swing man right here, right? Like let's assume that maybe Drew could be like the secondary playmaker too, because he's a really good shooter. He has more scoring tendencies than most point guards anyway. Like, he's not really a natural point guard in the first place. Like, he tries to be, so he's not like a selfish player by any means either, but he might not even necessarily be like the ideal pick and roll partner for Davis.
Right. I like him there, and I think that it's realistic to say that it's unlikely that the Pelicans will do better than him. But the real risk for New Orleans, and they can handle this through communications because that is something they can do, but they need to know what he wants, because there are going to be a lot of different offers for him. Probably not being the starting point guard for a championship contender. I assume that's not going to be on the table. Maybe not even the starting point guard for a fringe contender, like, let's say, the Celtics. Like, I don't think the Celtics are going to offer him a ton of money. They already have Isaiah. They already have so many other things. But that next tier down, you're going to have very different things. Does he want to live in a specific type of city? Does he want to play with a certain type of teammates? And
I'd actually like him on the Pacers.
Yeah, I was actually going to, that was something I thought of when we were talking, is he would fit well with Paul George. That would be a nice circumstance. I've also thought about,
it'd be devastating defensively too.
Oh, yeah, and Miles Turner. You'd have a really nice foundation. The other two spots, you could go in so many different directions. And what I would probably do, if they were able to pull that off, would be have a bunch of really different guys for that first year or two, and just see what works. And then get more players that are like that. So if they can get CJ Miles to come back, which might be kind of hard considering how they've been jerking him around the rotation, Thaddeus Young, you know, all those sorts of things. Just see what works, see what doesn't work, trade the guys that don't work, keep the guys that do, try to find some more players, and find a five-man lineup. But they would be awesome.
Yeah, I mean, that's a core you can do a lot of stuff around.
Would you like Drew next to Jimmy in Chicago?
Yeah, I mean, you want to talk about devastating defensively, right there.
Yeah,
and he spaces the floor out for them too, which is like, the Bulls really, really need that. They need a secondary creator too. I mean, as much as Wade's had a surprisingly good season for like what my expectations were, but yeah, like, they have a needed point guard. MCW is stepping in and trying to fill the gaps as best he can, which he's actually doing a pretty good job of, a lot better than I thought he would. But yeah, I mean, that would be a huge windfall for them, I think.
So basically, we've decided Drew Holiday should just go everywhere at the same time.
That's like what we were talking about earlier, though. He fits everywhere. He's perfect.
He'd fit in Orlando too, because they need anyone with a pulse.
Yeah. Although I like the way Peyton's playing lately, though.
Yeah.
So.
Peyton's doing well. I think that he's earned the right to, that you don't want to spend a ton of money on a starter unless the right guy comes around at point guard. Maybe you give him another year to figure it out. But at the same point, you talk to a lot of guys, you know, Patty Mills, if you were interested in coming, but maybe you don't.
And Patty Mills isn't really necessarily a guy who would threaten Peyton's development.
Yeah, you work that, and then if he drastically outplays Peyton, the problem is that they spent so much money on DJ Augustine, and DJ Augustine is all right, that maybe they don't throw anything at point guard, but they can also wait another year if they have to.
Yeah, Peyton's one of those guys that is regrettably one of the victims of the statistical revolution in my eyes, because I like the way that guys like him play ideally, like the way that he's playing right now. But when you can't really shoot, you really, really need to be good at everything else. And he has improved as a finisher. He's always theoretically had the passing ability, and I think it's starting to come to fruition. But it's just so hard when you don't have the jumper, though. You really just need to fill in every other gap, which he could do, but it's just, you know, it's just a tough needle to thread.
He was just born 15 years too late.
Yeah, pretty much.
It happens. It's very unfortunate, and he can still be a good player, can still be a productive part of a good team, but we're seeing this with Rubio too, that if you have that specific constraint, it is very hard to reach those high levels in terms of team offense. Granted, the Magic aren't doing him any favors, because a lot of the other elements of that team are not conducive. My big hope for Orlando, it's a very basic one, but whatever they do, just end up with Aaron Gordon starting at power forward. I don't care what else happens, just do that.
Yeah.
A very basic goal. Just have your best young player playing the position that he actually can play.
Yeah, that would be a really, really great story. I also have to ask you, because I think, I don't remember, but I think you were pretty high on him. How does it feel knowing that Mario Hezonja is just, like, not an NBA player?
It's tough. But those things happen. You know, like, with Hezonja, the idea with him that I always intrigued me with him, and I said this back when he was 17, was he was effectively another try at J.R. Smith. So the idea was that J.R. Smith was so physically talented, could do a lot of different things, sometimes he got in his own way, that my idea was that there's a better J.R. Smith out there, and my hope was that Hezonja was going to be that guy.
Mm-hmm. And then J.R. Smith ended up being that guy.
Yeah, and I have gained a greater appreciation for not only what even the more disappointing iteration of J.R. Smith was, but also just how much worse it could have been, because he has not been able to create his jump shot reliably. He's not been able to capitalize on the opportunities created by other people. I am not totally willing to write him off. He is like Ben McLemore. He is a player that a change of scenery, like I'm not saying I would throw like a big contract at him, but if I could take a flyer on him, considering the other players Orlando has sold low on that were also good, if you could get him for a middling second round pick, just to see if maybe it was the circumstance that was screwing him. Like, we're seeing more from Stauskas now, and Stauskas was just completely screwed up in Sacramento. There's a possibility, but the overwhelming probability is that he just isn't good enough.
Yeah, that's definitely a good point. It's been one of the worst places for a young player to develop as of late. I think we're seeing that with Oladipo now too, especially considering how much potential there was in his rookie year.
Well,
that kind of just got floundered. Yeah.
Like, look at what Harkless is compared to where he was. Not only is it the fact that they got him for nothing, but the Blazers have put him in a good circumstance where he's not asked to do a lot offensively, but can be himself defensively, and he's turned into a really nice player.
Yeah, certainly. That's a really good point. I mean, he's definitely one of the guys, like, especially when Amino was out, like, he really helped keep them afloat as far as role-playing and just doing like little things goes, because that also is just like a result of them having very, very little of that. But Harkless has really developed into one of those like a lesser version of like the leave nothing on the table type of guys, for sure.
Right, and if they put an even better defensive center around that team, Harkless could be even more valuable. They just don't have that guy yet, and probably never will, because I can never have everything I want.
Aww.
But maybe they get Nerlens and then that way it'll work out, but probably not.
Yeah, it's not necessarily likely, but...
Thanks so much for taking the time. Always a pleasure to talk with you.
Yeah, thanks for having me on.
Thanks again to Sarah Sohi for taking the time to come on. You can read her Clay Thompson piece at Sports on Earth, and you can read her other work all over the place. She's very talented, written for Rolling Stone, for Vice, so many other places. And you can also follow her on Twitter at Damian Trillard, DamianTrillard. Really did enjoy talking with her and going through all of the nuances and things that are going on in the league. And I enjoy this time that's about a month before the trade deadline because we get to learn a lot more before things start happening. And so you can speculate, you can think about what you want to see, and a lot of different elements that are in place, seeing different teams get hot, get cold. Rudy Gay injury, of course, changes some dynamics, and the Nuggets doing well, and everything in the East. The East is so up in the air at the moment. So enjoying all of that. Hope you enjoyed the episode as well. Going to go in a lot of different directions as usual for Real Jam Radio, depending on guest availability and everything of that sort over the next few weeks, just really seeing how all of this works out. If you want to give any feedback, good, bad, indifferent, you can certainly do so at DannyLaRueMBA@gmail.com or at DannyLarue on Twitter, DannyLaRueX. I read everything, respond to what I can, but I can't make any promises. Also, you can check out this show and so many other excellent podcasts on CLNS Radio. They have their own app. You can check it out and go through this podcast, numerous other stuff, and they're adding more every day. I'm very excited with some of the new additions that they've had, including my friend Sam Vecini having his excellent Game Theory podcast, which I go on when I can, and have a lot of other, of course, stuff going on. Locked On Warriors, Dunked On, the Twitter NBA show, which will return next week on Wednesday, I believe. And lots of great stuff going on, of course, working through a million different things at once, which is par for the course for me. If you want to support this show, there are a lot of different great ways you can do it. You can leave a rating, leave a review in whatever podcast player you use. You can also subscribe and download every episode. Those are major things that you can do to help. And also you can check out our sponsors, ZipRecruiter.com/sportsfan if you want to post jobs for free. Audible.com/try now for a free month subscription and an audiobook with that trial. And also our good friends at Blue Apron, blueapron.com/realgm, and you can get 3 meals for free, including free shipping on your first order. All of those things not only give you great products for discounted rates, or in the case of ZipRecruiter and Audible for free, but also it tells them that you came from us, which gives them further motivation to advertise with us in the future, help keep the lights on here, and also encourage future advertisers, that because engagement rates and things of that nature can be really helpful, just like leaving a rating, leaving a review in terms of rankings for iTunes and everything else. So thank you so much for listening. Take care and make it a great day.